and welcome to the Money Talk podcast. I'm Ed Monk. Today on the show, we'll take the temperature of the ongoing wrangling at the COP26 summit on climate change. What can be agreed on climate targets? What are the stumbling blocks? And what does it all mean for economies and markets in the future? If you enjoy the show, please rate us, share us, or leave a comment wherever you get your podcasts. If we didn't already know, the COP26 summit of world leaders that's taking place in Glasgow right now is making it clear how difficult it will be to make progress on climate change. Not all the major players are even in Glasgow, while many of those that are there have been quick to lay out why they want to soft pedal on hard targets to reduce carbon emissions. So what can we expect from the talks, and how might it affect the prospects for economies and markets in the future? To discuss that, I'm joined by Tom Stevenson, Investment Director here at Fidelity. Tom, welcome along. Now, you wrote in advance of the summit last week, in fact, about the difficulties there will be in reaching agreement on carbon targets. Why don't you lay out, Tom, the size of the challenge here in terms of where we need to get to collectively in these talks?
Yeah, OK, that's a good place to start, Ed. I think there is general agreement now, certainly in the mainstream of people that accept that, climate change is a thing and that it's real. There's always going to be people on the fringes that cast doubt on this. But, there is general agreement, I think, that there are a number of goals that we need to reach, targets we need to achieve if we are to avert some kind of a climate catastrophe in the years and decades to come. And broadly speaking, they boil down to reducing carbon emissions by a very significant amount. We're talking about halving carbon emissions around the world over the next 10 years. And that's really what the urgency is about now, which is why people are talking about this Glasgow summit being the last chance to really make a difference. The clock is ticking. We have to reduce carbon emissions very dramatically over a relatively short space of time. Taking that a bit further, there's general agreement that we need to reach a position of net zero emissions. So carbon emissions being offset by measures that take carbon out of the environment by 2050. So that's 30 years away. And why are we doing this? Because only by reducing carbon emissions will we reduce or cap the increase in global temperatures, average global temperatures, to 1.5% above the pre-industrial level. So the experts say that unless we can limit the temperature rises to 1.5 degrees, then the climate change becomes unstoppable and uncontrollable.
Yeah, so in other words, we're going to have to reverse decades, maybe even hundreds of years of industrialization and the carbon that produces in a very short period of time, right? I mean, there's no getting around that.
Yeah, there's no getting around it. We've been doing this for, 150, 200 years, and we've probably got 10 years in which to make, very significant strides towards reversing that.
And I mean, I was a bit pessimistic, Tom, in my introduction about the progress that can be made here. But we need, I think, to be positive. But you did give some examples in your writing of where individual countries do face difficulties in making these promises to reduce carbon, even if they kind of believe in the case that you've laid out there. Wouldn't want to make an example of anyone in particular, but you mentioned Australia as one country where it has political pressures pulling it in different directions. And I guess different countries will have a version of that equation to square away.
Yeah, the reality of it is that not all countries are the same. Some are worse polluters. They're at different stages in their industrial development. In the case of Australia, which you mentioned, fossil fuels, particularly thermal coal, is a very significant part of their export economy. So because of that, there are political pressures from voters on politicians not to make the changes which the rest of the world are calling for. So in the case of Australia, rather belatedly, rather grudgingly, they did sign up to this pledge to target net zero carbon emissions by 2050. But crucially, they didn't really spell out how they were going to do that at the same time as protecting those fossil fuel export industries, which is what they claim that they are going to be able to do. So there's a mismatch there between the rhetoric and the reality, probably. We had another example just this week, India. India, I think, is the third biggest emitter of carbon after China and the US. And India has signed up to achieving net zero by 2070. Now, that's 20 years after the rest of the world. And, you know, if you believe the doomsayers, that's just, you know, that's just way too late. I mean, you know, 50 years away is just too long. We have to act more quickly than that.
And it's perhaps too long from the target's point of view, but it also just is demoralising when you put that kind of long tail or long time frame on everything, because, you know, being realistic, we're in 2021, 2070. You and I, Tom, may not be around to see that. It doesn't exactly put much pressure on the leaders today to do much when we're talking about targets that far in the future.
Yes, and actually highlights another problem as well, which is that which I sort of hinted at, which is that India is the third biggest polluter, third biggest emitter of carbon. What India does matters a great deal more, actually, than what, you know, for example, we do in the UK. I was looking at the figures earlier on, actually, and the carbon emissions from those big three, from China, the US and India, are many multiples of the emissions of, you know, even quite sort of industrial countries like Germany, for example, which is quite a big emitter of carbon. But compared to those giant companies, you know, because they have very big populations, because they're very big, big countries, it's what they do that really, really matters. And that's why it's so concerning, I suppose, that, you know, the likes of China and Russia are not even really being represented at the highest level at these COP26 talks.
Yeah. And just one note, perhaps in sort of defence, maybe, of some of those countries, you can look at it at the sort of country level, but you can also look at it at the per capita level, can't you? And I think per capita, the US is still the, you know, per capita, the biggest polluter. So, you know, every country can come armed with its own sort of arguments about why action would be fair or unfair.
Yeah, that's a very good point. I mean, you know, if you look at the, I've actually got the figures in front of me here now. I mean, the US, 15 tons of CO2 per capita. China, despite actually emitting twice as much carbon in total as the US, only 7 tons of carbon. So it emits twice as much, but its population is 4 times the size of America. So, you know, it's all very well for the US to point the finger at China, but the reality is that on a per capita basis, the Americans are extremely profligate with their use of finite resources.
Indeed. Now, Tom, we are obviously looking at this through the lens of investments and finance. And you and I have spoken before about the role that financial markets have to play in all of this. There's an ongoing debate. There's several ongoing debates, in fact, about the best approach of how you can use capital to encourage the reduction of carbon use. At a high level, Tom, can you lay out where that argument is at the moment?
Yes, well, I mean, one of the key arguments in this regard is the question of whether, you know, big investors like Fidelity, where we work, you know, whether their role in this is to engage with companies, to speak to them, to help them understand their use of carbon and understand how they can reduce that and mitigate it, or whether the role of the big investor is simply to use their financial clout by taking their money away, by divesting, disinvesting from the worst polluters. And the thinking there is that, you know, if you direct your money towards the best performing companies in terms of green measures, environmental measures, and you take it away from the worst performing, from the polluters, then that is the most powerful way of actually shaping change in the environmental sphere. And that's it's a reasonable argument, but I think there's also a very strong argument for the contrary approach, which is to say, look, we are actually much better off working with these companies, engaging with them, because if we don't do it, they're not going to stop doing what they're doing because some less scrupulous investor will come along and simply invest in those companies, because by taking our capital away, we effectively make those companies cheaper, more attractive to less scrupulous investors. We don't actually solve the problem. And so if you're thinking about this from an outcomes perspective, then you can argue that engagement is more likely to have a positive outcome than disinvestment.
Yeah, and just to expand on that a bit more, that engagement approach, I suppose that's saying that maybe at a high level, an institutional investor might have its own targets for reducing carbon emissions amongst its activities, including the companies it invests in. It can have those targets and then it can go to the companies that it invests in where it should wield a lot of influence and say, look, we have these targets. We want you to reduce your carbon emissions to help us meet them. Otherwise, we will disinvest. That's sort of the other part of that engagement argument. It's a sort of threat that disinvestment could come, but only after an attempt at engagement has been made.
Yes, indeed. I mean, there is an element of carrot and stick about this. And I think that, again, it's a spectrum. And I think some people would think that big investors should be wielding the stick a bit earlier in the process, a bit more forcefully, and say, look, you've got to do this. And if you don't do it, we will take our money away.
Yeah. So, Tom, if we are positive about all this and say that leaders in the next couple of weeks will come up with some firm targets, how will that influence growth and markets in the future? Is it the case that lowering carbon use at a global level just has to mean lower growth, right? I mean, there's just less economic activity tends to go in hand with carbon emitting. And so does it then just follow that if we have lower carbon use, we're going to have lower growth?
I think it's fair to say that there really is, no free lunch here. I don't think that we can... we can achieve these targets and not expect there to be some sort of economic consequence. Now, it's more complicated than that because actually the greening of the global economy, the changing to a more shifting to a more renewable energy infrastructure around the world represents an absolutely massive investment opportunity. If you think how sort of, fundamental the generation of power is to the global economy, then shifting it from one fossil fuel based way of generating power to a more renewable one is going to require absolutely massive investment. And that represents an opportunity. But and thereby hangs the flip side of that. Is that it also represents a potentially very big driver of inflation. Just creating all of these, wind turbines, solar power and everything like that is going to suck in all sorts of resources, which is going to push the prices higher. So, I think it's a two-part answer, really. Yes, in some ways it probably does lower growth. In some ways it probably raises growth. In some ways it probably creates problems like inflation. In the long run, of course, it creates a more sustainable and better future. So as with all things climate change related, there isn't a simple answer, I'm afraid.
No, I mean, I don't know. I look at these arguments and you'd think that there would be a huge prize here for the countries and the societies that can really shift to a renewable power base. And suddenly you'll be less reliant on global markets. We're seeing right now, right? I mean, the global energy market can hit everyone in their pockets because we've all got to pay for this stuff. And if you are, as a country, less reliant on global energy supply through fossil fuels, that's a great offering for your society, isn't it? Because you can... you can shield yourselves from the kind of inflation that we have been seeing right now.
Yes, absolutely. The trouble is that the benefit is some way down the track, and the cost is potentially right now. And that is why this is such a challenge, because, you know, climate change respects no boundaries. You know, it is completely ignorant of, and it doesn't care about nationalities. And, you know, we are all in this together. And, you know, I was going to mention earlier on about, you know, the sort of financial side of this. You know, there is a very strong argument that rich countries have a moral obligation to help poorer countries to become more renewable, more sustainable themselves. And it's not just a moral obligation. They will benefit from this in the end. But persuading voters at home that that's the right approach, especially if it causes inflation in the short term, if it reduces people's standard of living in the short term, is a very difficult political ask. And I think that's the big political and moral challenge for leaders today, is that actually they are being asked in an era of populism to do something which is potentially very unpopular.
Yeah, indeed. Well, Tom, that's a slightly negative note to end on. We will try to be positive about all these issues, of course, and I dare say we'll return to them again and again. But Tom, that is all that we have time for today. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks, Ed.
You've been listening to the Money Talk podcast. Check fidelity.co.uk for daily written updates and articles on these and other topics from across Fidelity in the UK. And subscribe via iTunes to get the podcast downloaded direct to your devices every week. Please be aware that the value of investments and the income you get from them can go down as well as up, so you may not get back what you invest. This information doesn't constitute investment advice and should not be used as the basis for any investment decision, nor should it be treated as a recommendation for any investment. Eligibility to invest in an ISA or a pension and the value of tax savings depends on personal circumstances, and all tax rules may change. You will not normally be able to access money held in a pension until the age of 55. Reference to specific securities or funds should not be construed as a recommendation to buy or sell these securities or funds, and is included for the purpose of illustration only. Fidelity Personal Investing does not give personal recommendations. If you're unsure about the suitability of an investment, you should speak to an authorised financial advisor.